Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, February 5th, 2024. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio. Let's get right into some headlines from around New Mexico. Demetrio Trujillo, a 42-year-old Albuquerque man, admitted in federal court documents filed Friday to carrying out drive-by shootings targeting the homes of Democratic lawmakers. Trujillo says he was hired by Solomon Pena, a failed Republican candidate for political office, accused of orchestrating the shooting plot. Trujillo pleaded guilty to charges, including election interference, criminal conspiracy, and firearms-related offenses. His son, Jose Luis Trujillo, pleaded guilty last month to 5 charges, including conspiracy and election interference. Pena is scheduled for trial in June, also on charges of conspiracy and election interference, along with gun and drug charges. The shootings happened after officials certified Pena's loss in the state House race for District 14 in December 2022 and January 2023. Investigators linked Pena to the attacks through smartphone communications, claiming the election was rigged, and later detailing plans to intimidate officials. Legislators in the House Judiciary Committee will consider House Bill 19 this week. If passed, it would make it a felony from the 2024 election onwards to knowingly submit a fake elector certificate. Despite Republican objections, the move aligns with similar measures in other states. Republican electors signed certificates in 7 states falsely stating that Trump had won the 2020 election. In New Mexico, President Joe Biden won by 11 percentage points, the largest margin in those states where the so-called fake electors participated. The bill addresses concerns from New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres, who decided not to prosecute Republicans involved in the 2020 incident. The city of Albuquerque is receiving the largest chunk of $16.5 million in federal funding coming to New Mexico for homelessness assistance. The money is part of the more than $3 billion Continuum of Care initiative from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Albuquerque will receive $3.5 million, with the rest of the money benefiting 26 organizations statewide. As quoted in the Albuquerque Journal, Senator Martin Heinrich says New Mexico has not kept up with the demand for housing, with a lagging number of units driving up prices of existing options, which is leading some people to become homeless. The city will divide the federal money up between nonprofit agencies that specialize in rapid rehousing and permanent supportive housing. Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless is another group that will receive some of the money, using it to assist families and households to cover escalating rents. Senator Heinrich is pushing for additional incentives with local reforms to combat housing shortages in New Mexico. We're just over halfway through this year's 30-day legislative session, and several days past the deadline for elected officials to introduce new bills at the Roundhouse. The final tally of bills and resolutions stands just shy of 700, and we've already seen several major gun control proposals endorsed by the governor advance through the process. Senate Bill 69, which originally would have required a 14-day waiting period to purchase a firearm, passed the Senate House and Public Affairs Committee, but was amended and shortened to just 7 days, and has now passed the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senate Bill 5, which would ban guns inside all statewide polling places and within 100 feet of a main entrance during early voting days and election day, is now on its way to House Judiciary after the Senate passed it last week by a vote of 26 to 16. We're also seeing progress on bills related to the environment, education, the State Children, Youth, and Families Department, and several other issues. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham put a lot in front of lawmakers during this year's short session, something that she was quick to admit when she sat down in her office with correspondent Gwyneth Doland and detailed how her agenda is progressing as the session passes its midway point.
Governor Lujan Grisham, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
Well, we appreciate your time. It's a busy session. You took this session a multi-pronged approach to your public safety agenda. You've got a package of sort of tough-on-crime bills and then some gun bills, among other things. Somewhat surprisingly, the gun bills are the ones that are moving. And we would have thought those would have been a harder sell. But just this week, the banning guns in polling places and a 14-day waiting period advanced. Do incremental restrictions like this have real potential to improve New Mexicans' safety?
I believe they do, or I wouldn't do it. And I certainly wouldn't do it in a 30-day session. And you know, people are sort of pressured to do special sessions. You have to have a meaningful end result, and there has to be evidence. And there's evidence that suggests if we can curb people who should never have guns from having guns and we don't want weapons of mass destruction anywhere in our communities. And anything I can do to prevent a mass shooting in any context is worth doing. And I am actually a little surprised that those are moving. And I would say that Albuquerque is a good example of people have had enough. They can see it. We've done thousands of arrests since the public health order. And I think people are saying, you know, I'm feeling a little bit better and safer. And the number of guns we've taken off the streets, that becomes that visual is visceral, right? You feel it. And I think that has a lot to do with this momentum.
You are very lucky as a governor to have such strong Democratic majorities in the State House and State.
Am I?
Well, that's funny, because is it part of your strategy, I want to know, to show that New Mexico can be a sort of a proving ground for some of the issues that animate Democrats nationwide?
Well, no. I'm really serious about public safety, and I think for far too long, Democrats don't get enough respect about the work that they're trying to do. And quite frankly, in today's political climate, you are either very conservative, so we do nothing, or you're incredibly liberal, and we could make one mistake with someone we might arrest or detain. And when we're operating in those kinds of extremes, things typically don't get better, and people get more hostile in the policymaking environment. I think Democrats have to learn to talk seriously about safety. I think we have to be really clear. Our kids are at risk, and more kids are engaged directly in gun violence, and younger and younger and younger. And to pretend that this trend isn't occurring is flat wrong. And I've learned some lessons as a politician that these are areas no one's comfortable with because it's hard to find middle ground.
How much of the problem you are trying to fight is the perception of crime?
That's a hard question to answer. I think that perception, even if the facts don't always bear out that crime is rising. So for example, you probably are aware that we can show that a lot of crime is actually headed in the right direction. It's diminishing in Albuquerque. Violent crime has been stagnant. It's still high and it's not really moving, but I think we're gonna see a dip, and it's exactly what we should expect. But if we don't have the right prevention, support to families, do something about poverty, better education, the answer to crime is always jobs. Well, 110,000 jobs just in the last 3 years. It's not a perception. There is a climate around the world of animosity and anxiety. There are a lot of guns that are available far too easy. I think that we are enamored. I think there's a negative gun culture. That combination has proven to be quite disturbing and dangerous in America. And if New Mexico, and I believe we will, if we can get on top of it and squeeze it from both ends, I think people won't have a debate about perception and what stat means this or another. But when I feel safe going out in the ditches in Albuquerque, I miss them. Going for a jog at 3:30, or maybe it's a little bit late, summer, 6 o'clock, by myself, I'm gonna feel like I'm not quite done, because that's the community I grew up in, and everyone deserves a chance to grow up in a neighborhood where they feel that safe.
I wanna talk about kids and safety, CYFD. The agency charged with protecting New Mexico's most vulnerable children is arguably broken. There is a proposal up here now that would take the agency away from the executive, away from your purview, and give it to an independent commission. Where do you stand on that?
I'm not a big fan of that. I mean, certainly there have been reports the legislature is trying to take executive power, and these are debates that aren't new. And usually this long into an administration, those debates resurface. But take a look at our boards and commissions, lots of complaints, sometimes regents. Take a look at some of our universities and whether they trend in the right direction. You create another layer of bureaucracy. And who is accountable then? One of those board members, five of those board members, some of those board members. CYFD in every state. Child welfare, that system is broken because we don't invest in families or in kids or in well-being. And it's in every one of my departments. That's not an excuse for issues in CYFD, but I think the public should know maybe a couple of things. Protective Services, where we do our investigations, it has less money right now with a democratically controlled majority, supermajority in the House than it did when we got here. You can't be serious about doing the investigations and catching up if you're not going to fund that. It's a, unfortunately, hot button issue like immigration, and it is so in every state. I don't care whether you're a Republican governor or a Democratic governor. In fact, when I ran in 18, words like beleaguered, people who are running it not qualified, there are no staff there. And we did, in fact, we inherited a 40% vacancy rate in many of our departments, including that one. If those are the headlines, is that a department you want to work? Are you worried about that risk? You bet you are. I'm feeling like the issue I could have addressed better in 2019 is I kept hiring brilliant policymakers. But I have a lot of help on the policy. I needed managers, coaches, and I need folks who understand what it takes in a public context to deliver that personnel response to kiddos. And we are going to do a lot of policy work. And the next session will be all about complete revamping of the child well-being system and different accountability so that every governor gets a fair start with CYFD, because most governors, I would argue, haven't gotten a fair start. And that means kids and their families don't get what they deserve from this state. And I bet that I can deliver that before I leave.
I want to move on to climate. You've made climate a signature issue. There are advocates out there for climate saying the number one thing that the governor could do now is lower the amount of oil and gas production that's happening in the state, lower the amount of stuff that we're pulling out of the earth. Why have you not pushed for a cap on production?
Well, I've looked at some of that caps on production, so I'm not sure that they work in the way that we think they do. Two, that doesn't stop Texas from taking all of that same oil right out, and they don't clean it up. They don't require recycled water. They don't have a methane rule. They don't change the pneumatic valves. And as weird as this sounds, and it sounds even weird to me, I'm going to say it anyway, we produce the cleanest barrel oil, cleanest natural gas in the world. Well, it's still a fossil fuel, and it still gets burned, and it still emits greenhouse gases. But we're setting the standard, including in methane capture. You want the rest of the world that's going to keep producing oil to get where we are? Lead by example. And while you do that, more aggressively invest in renewable energy and a real transition. And I think that we're going to start to beat states without it being a per capita analysis, because we're small, 2 million people. I think that we're going to win the race on these transitions. Now, a lot of it depends on our transmission. Nobody wants those either, because they...
transition lines coming through communities, they look ugly.
And they are emitters. I mean, even when you put green electrons on, there is no completely universal, simple issue. And that's because we waited too long. But I want New Mexico to lead the country, and we can make all of it better while we lean really heavily into renewables, including individual responsibility, and we've got more good solar policies and practices than certainly any of our neighboring states, but most states in the country. And I'm going to keep doing just that. And I also want folks to know, you know, governors are not omnipotent. And I don't have the power on private land or with Texas or with anyone to do all of that stuff. And it is simple. And in a weak moment, of course, when I look at my grandchildren, I just want to wave a magic wand, and I want there to be no more carbon emitted anywhere in the world. But I don't have that. But I can be aggressive and pragmatic, and I can do my part to save the earth and to make sure that New Mexico leads in that space.
There is a movement up here this session to help the legislature get more done. Senator Peter Wirth told us he wants three things in terms of modernization: paid legislators, paid staff for those lawmakers, and longer sessions, 60-day sessions every year. You are an ambitious leader, and you had a big agenda this session. Do lawmakers need all of that to keep up with you?
Right. They've managed, even so, and actually Lederwurst said this morning, and so did at the Presbyterian prayer breakfast, the governor's prayer breakfast, that we've gotten a lot done, more than probably all of the predecessors. I have a tendency to push hard and try to get everything done. I want it all. I want perfection. Yeah, and I would suspect that there's a lot of governors out there, but you worry about the political ramifications when you push too hard, and I haven't been very good about worrying about that. So I don't think you need 60 days every time, because they get it done. But I don't have the pressure of trying to get it all done. And I do think that when it's fast and it's furious, it can lead to more tension and sometimes not as deliberative an environment. I certainly wouldn't stand in the way of those efforts. But the one thing that's very personal, that I don't know how they'll find the balance. These are professionals who dedicate their lives in a voluntary way year round to policymaking. It doesn't end. No staff, they don't get paid, and it minimizes where you can work, because you're voting on all sorts of issues and regulatory aspects that could affect a business that you might be in. So it really hamstrings who can be a policymaker. When we make it full-time, or nearly full-time, or change it so that it's more time, and when we pay the legislators, because I think that's inevitable, because these are professionals, it won't be as friendly and it won't be as inviting. It'll be a different format. Look at Congress, look at legislatures around the world. They get a little bit more complicated and a little bit more formal. And for a state that prides itself on relationships, and I have kids up here all day, every day, I love it. And I wonder if all those kids are going to get to come, or if they have to make appointments, and is it really Education Day, or is it some other day?
But I mean, do we want it to be comfortable, or do we want to get stuff done?
I think you can do both. So when they become that paid, more typical legislature that shows respect to the policymakers, my hope, I probably won't be here, but my hope is they keep it informal and they keep it kind, and that they remember that they did a lot even without that, and they're capable of remarkable things.
Before we get out of here, we're halfway through the short session. What are three things you absolutely have to have before the gavel is down?
Well, I've made it really clear that this public safety agenda is serious. And while these gun bills are moving, there are others. So I want the full gamut, right? So increase penalties where they should be. It's certainly not revising the whole criminal code so that we're just doing that. And I need more money for kids, for after school programs. Those aren't funded if you're going to really do the whole effort. I need CYFD fully funded. I need to make sure that my police retention and recruitment fund is full. It's working. We have 500 new officers. Why would you stop doing that now? I want the other 500. And I want to make sure that as we start to negotiate the tax package, that all the environmental incentives are in that tax package. And last but not least, this strategic water supply, I need to keep explaining it. I need to make sure that any of the constructive criticism about what it could do, that I do my work to convince New Mexicans. I believe in a state that doesn't have enough water, that this is a game changer that protects first and foremost consumers and families, improves the health of kiddos, and creates that real transition into an incredible economic powerhouse, and that strategic water effort will lend itself to the rest of the West and to places like Africa. And I'm really excited about that work, and taxpayers don't front a nickel, not until we get something that we want. And I'm going to fight hard to make sure that gets upstairs.
Governor, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much.
One major proposal that did meet an early end is Senate Bill 122, which would have required defendants in some felony cases to convince judges that they aren't a danger to the public in order to be released from jail before trial. That's instead of the state being required to prove the opposite, which is how it works now. The Senate Health and Public Affairs Committee voted 5-4 to table the measure, meaning it's as good as dead. But when it comes to making it harder for alleged violent offenders to get out ahead of trial, the governor says that she's not done. She told our Gwyneth Dolan this week that some version of the bill might make a comeback, but couldn't provide many details. The deadline for filing new legislation has already passed, which means the governor and her allies would have to use a procedural trick to resurrect the bill. Take a listen.
Democrats have blocked you on some of your proposals, like pretrial detention. Now, judges do already have the power to do this if prosecutors can prove that it's necessary. But some Democrats up here just insist that it is unconstitutional. Why keep pushing for it?
Well, because I've seen the difference it makes, even in today in Albuquerque, was the only place we're doing it, with young people who are involved in gun violence. You know, we're now detaining them. And 100 people, we can show you, have recommitted a crime, and many of them violent crime. I think the debate, just as I described, got too far on either side. We do have an obligation and a constitutional requirement to protect people from being detained unconstitutionally. You are guilty, you are innocent until proven guilty. No one wants that standard to be eroded in any context, and if we did, the feds would hold us accountable. But you also have to be clear, when you have repeat offenders and you have violent offenders and the police stop arresting them and people stop calling 911, now we have a real problem in our communities. So we're fighting on the fringes. I think maybe we've been approaching the dialogue about this not as effectively as we could have. And that is this, that I'm still sort of in that framework of it's got to be all one way. Look, we don't want anyone innocent who isn't a real threat being held unconstitutionally, or even if that wasn't the standard. Why would we want that? But if we can talk about it in a way that says we need safeguards for the community, can we describe those safeguards a bit differently so that it cues the judges to ask more serious questions about the patterns of crime, and we train DAs and PDs to engage in that dialogue? I think we could get some better results. We're seeing better results just by talking about it with judges. So I think that's an indication we've potentially made some mistakes. And I want to get it to a place where it becomes routine. Having it be routine means you get it in statute. And I think it doesn't have to just be like the federal standard, which is what I introduced. But stay tuned, because I think we might have another path forward.
We'll wait to see if and when a massaged pretrial detention bill resurfaces, and we'll be sure to let you know if it does. Now, to nail down the thought process behind instituting a stricter system, we turn to Bernalillo County District Attorney Sam Bregman. He's been one of the most vocal salesmen for big changes to pretrial detention in the state. In an interview recorded days before Senate Bill 122 died, Bregman explains what prosecutors must do now in court to keep someone in jail and why he thinks the system needs more protections. Bernalillo County District Attorney Sam Bregman, thanks so much for joining me here on New Mexico in Focus.
It's a pleasure. Good to be here.
Thank you. Now, we just laid out the landscape surrounding pretrial detention and the governor's repeated calls to change it. I'd like to start by asking you to explain how things work now. What exactly must your prosecutors do and prove in court to keep someone in jail before trial?
Well, let's go back a little bit. Bail reform took place several years back, and basically the idea, and I supported bail reform and I still do, in the sense that nobody should be kept in jail simply because they can't afford to pay bail based on how much money they have. That is an unacceptable result. So we know that there are certain people, however, that because of their actions, because of the charges against them, perhaps because of their violent history, if you will, the charges are so severe in the sense of violence in the community, the safety of the community is at stake. There are certain people that should not be let out pending trial for the safety of the community. So it's a really important issue for us as prosecutors, because we know that too often folks that are violent in nature, folks that have been charged with violent crimes and have a history of violent crimes, while they're waiting for that trial date, they commit another violent crime, and the community suffers deeply because of it. So, of course, we have some burdens now, and we welcome any burden under the law that we need to do to keep them held. We file pretrial detention motions currently, which is that our burden basically is to show that based on the charges, based on the history, based on what's going on, there is no reasonable condition that can be put on that defendant to ensure the safety of the community. And because of that, judges have to sit back and make a decision at this point.
So one phrase that we do hear a lot under the current system is catch and release. We've heard it in elections. And the idea there, the perception there, is that suspected criminals are often arrested, booked, thrown right back onto the street, regardless of what they're charged with. Is that phrase accurate?
I'm not a big fan of the phrase catch and release, because I think it demeans the criminal justice system. There are a lot of moving parts in the criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system is not perfect, but it's the best that the world's ever known. And I feel very strongly about that. Obviously, someone is presumed innocent until and unless they are proven guilty in a court of law. That's a very important fundamental right that every person in this country has. At the same time, we have seen instances where someone has been released pretrial. And just as I mentioned earlier, they've gone out and committed another horrific crime. And so people get very frustrated about that, rightfully so. The community gets outraged by something like that happening, rightfully so. So we need to do everything we can, I think. And I know that my office is doing that. Our pretrial detention success has gone up 10%, even after we filed more pretrial detention motions this last year than the year before. So we are having some success around the margins.
Those cases that you described, somebody getting out and maybe committing another crime, where is the point of failure in that process?
The point of failure, I don't know that there's a point of failure. I mean, nobody has a crystal ball. Nobody. And you'll never hear me criticize a court or a judge for a decision they've made in a courtroom. I'm an old school lawyer. I revere judges. I think the world of them. We as prosecutors in Bernalillo County, we'll do our arguing in a courtroom. And the judges will make their decision based on the evidence they have in front of them. Judges live in this community too. They understand the crime problem out there. I don't think I've ever seen a judge that takes it lightly or just flippantly releases somebody just because they can. I think these are well thought out decisions, and sometimes I don't agree with them. But you're not going to hear me complaining about it. You're going to hear me continuing to ensure that our office presents the best possible case, if you will, as far as evidence to show to a judge why this person should be held.
Now, something that you brought up earlier is that 2016 constitutional amendment that overhauled the state's pretrial release system. You said publicly and just now here that you still support it. You and over 80% of New Mexicans voted to give judges the power to hold people in jail before trial. Do you see any contradiction in also supporting a change that kind of turns that idea on its head, forcing defendants to prove that they are not a danger in order to be released?
No, I don't feel that there's any contradiction in the two. I still strongly support the idea of what bail reform was about, and that is nobody should be held incarcerated pending trial just because they can't afford the $100 or the $1,000 bail money that would be necessary to be posted so that they could be released through a bail bonding company. At the same time, though, we also know, and it doesn't have to be one or the other. We also understand that there are certain people, though, because of the violent nature of the crime they're accused of, or because of their history in violent crime, or because of their history in failing to ever follow a court order. In other words, they don't show up for court when they've been released before in a lower level case. They have a history of giving the middle finger, if you will, to a court and saying, I'm not going to listen to whatever you tell me. They have a history of cutting off an ankle bracelet, an ankle monitor that tracks GPS where someone is.
Now, in June of last year, UNM's Institute for Social Research put out data showing that pretrial detention in Bernalillo County, it's been up since you've been DA. Is that not evidence that the system is working right now and perhaps an argument against further change?
I think it's evidence that our prosecutors are doing a heck of a good job over in the district attorney's office. They're focused like a laser beam on trying to make sure we keep every single person who's a threat to the community held if they're facing severe criminal charges. I think it's a testament to how hard they work. I think it's also a testament to a recent Supreme Court case from the state, that Joe Anderson, that the Supreme Court just ruled on. But I don't think it's a testament that says we can't do better.
Thanks to DA Bregman for making the time to speak with me. In case you missed it, you can listen to his most recent public comments about the ongoing FBI investigation into APD's DWI unit on last week's episode of the podcast. Now back to that failed pretrial detention bill, which, in its original form of a rebuttable presumption, split the Democratic Party, with many members concerned that it would violate the state constitution. In an interview also recorded before SB 122 was tabled, Gwyneth caught up with Senate Majority Leader Peter Wirth to talk about why he didn't see eye to eye with the governor or DA Bregman.
Albuquerque District Attorney Sam Bregman told us on the show this week he needs help keeping the most violent offenders in jail before they're found guilty. Federal courts can do it. Why should we not have a rebuttable presumption and force defendants to prove that they are not a danger before we let them out of jail?
So the answer is the New Mexico Constitution. In our Constitution, we create a burden of proof and we place it on the prosecutors to show by clear and convincing evidence that someone is dangerous. Prior to that constitutional amendment, anyone that was dangerous could bail out and be on the street. We created a mechanism to hold dangerous defenders, and I want to encourage and commend DA Bregman for the job he has done in using the tool that's available. My feeling is we need to get him the resources to be able to implement the constitutional framework that's there.
Now, he told us he respectfully disagrees with that opinion. He thinks it is constitutional and the state Supreme Court should decide.
Well, again, I think that that's something we'll debate here, and obviously you've got a lot of lawyers that disagree, and I respectfully disagree with his opinion on that, and we'll continue to have the discussion.
For now, it appears Senator Wirth has won out, but we're keeping a close eye out for any changes to existing legislation that could impact the pretrial detention system. For more on the mechanics, the politics, and the history of proposals to revamp pretrial detention in New Mexico, head over to our website and read executive producer Jeff Proctor's essay. Thanks for listening this week. You can expect more interviews from Inside the Roundhouse again next Monday on the podcast. Be sure to follow our pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, February 5th, 2024. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.